Gavin Wood's Countdown Podcast, proudly brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hi, this is Glenn Shorrock, and you're listening to the Gavin Wood Countdown Podcast.
And he's on the line. Hello, Glenn.
On the line again. Yes, sir. How are you, Gavin?
Can you guess where I'm calling from? A studio not far, far, far away.
Yes, well, I'm not at the Las Vegas Hilton this time. but of course, I was a long time ago. Well, now I'm in Rushcutters Bay in Sydney.
Oh, that's very nice. I'd rather be there than locked down in Melbourne, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah, you guys are doing it tough. You have my sympathy.
Oh, thank you. But we'll get there. We're stoic people.
Yeah.
Now, let's go right back in the life of Glenn Shorrock. You were born in England. What part of England?
Kent. Just outside of London, a place called Rochester. And from the age of 0 to 10. And then my father said, we're going to Australia. And I said, oh, that's great, Dad. When do we leave? Now, for a 10-year-old boy, I was very excited about that. My mother was a little more trepidatious, shall we say.
Well, that's incredible, because usually at 10 you would have formed, you know, good school friends and all of that. It must have been a bit of a wrench for you.
No, I was looking forward to, you know, finding out that we were going on a big boat across the world to this place called Australia. I was right into it. As a young boy, I was very interested in geography and the rest of the world, you know. I had a penchant for that. And then lo and behold, I was on this lovely adventure. And we arrived in Fremantle, to the bright sunshine of Western Australia. But the places I saw as a boy were fantastic. The Rock of Gibraltar, Marseille, and the Pompeii and Naples, and the Suez Canal, India. It was fantastic. Great.
So what did your father do, Glenn?
A sheet metal worker, fitter and turner.
Mm-hmm.
In the factories, he helped make the Sunderland flying boats, you know, the ones that flew to Australia, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, even when I said made them, you know, he worked in the factory that made them.
Yeah. So there was probably an inkling there in the back of his mind. I'd love to go to Australia. So when the opportunity came, he jumped at it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think the war really made up his mind that things were not going to be the same in Europe, and decided to look about other things. I remember the brochures on the table. There was one for New Zealand, there was one for Canada, and they chose Australia.
So you came into Fremantle. How did you end up in Elizabeth?
Oh, well, we carried on. We were earmarked or programmed, shall we say, to go to Melbourne. That was where we were supposed to be going. And halfway across the bight, the immigration people who got on at Fremantle said, we've got too many people for Melbourne. Anybody here for Adelaide? Dad stuck his hand up. Yeah, we'll get off at Adelaide, he said. And there you go. I spent the first 3, 4, 6 months in a migrant hostel in Adelaide, and then things started to go a bit wrong with the family. Mum hated it. It was just, you know, she didn't like the heat. She didn't like the conditions. The migrant hostels back in 1954 were pretty basic. We lived in a tin shed, really. Listen, huh?
And that's pretty hot in summer.
Oh, very hot. Absolutely stifling. And then we shuffle around a bit, got a rental place north of Adelaide. But then Mum was still fed up, and so Dad said, listen, take the kids back. I'll follow on when I pay off the migrant contract. And that's what happened. Went back to Rochester. I went to secondary school. By this time, I did my 11 plus, which was, you know, the transition from primary education to secondary education. And then in 9 months, I can't remember. Mum said, I've made a mistake. We're going back to stay with Dad. So back we went again.
Oh, that's sweet. That's sweet. She missed him.
Yeah, she did. Yeah. And so we came back and lived in a rolling flat winery. Well, it wasn't a winery, yeah, really, but the wine was growing, of course, in the Barossa Valley, waiting for a housing commission place in Elizabeth, and finally got one in 1956, and that's where the trouble started. That's when I got involved with rock and roll and American culture hit Adelaide in a big way in 1956.
I'm speaking with Glenn Shorrock. The early years, the very early years of Glenn Shorrock, growing up in Elizabeth in South Australia. Now, did you have any inkling that you would like to get into music? Were you gifted at school, singing in the choir like Russell Morris?
No, I didn't really do anything like that, but I was very into this newfangled rock and roll. You know, I was right. I heard Elvis Presley with Heartbreak Hotel.
Yeah.
When I was twelve, and that changed everything. I just wanted to find out everything about this new. Now, Bill Haley had come along as well, Rock Around the Clock, and Little Richard really, I loved him.
How good was he? Fantastic. He was unbelievable.
He was the great voice of rock and roll, definitely.
Mm.
He's sad passing recently, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He shit scared my parents, though. bash, bump, thump, tuneless, flaming jungle music.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
how my dad described it.
So your dad wasn't musical? You just picked it up by yourself, right?
He was musical. He loved opera. He loved the great tenors of the world. My mother liked Sinatra, and, you know, we had a good appreciation of music at that time.
Mm.
But obviously rock and roll came along and changed everything for me.
What woman back then didn't like Sinatra? He was bigger than Elvis, wasn't he? He was huge.
Yeah. He was a sex symbol as well. But, no, I preferred Elvis and Heartbreak Hotel and All Shook Up and all those great rock and roll songs. And I used to dress up like him. I tried to cut myself a cardboard guitar, strung it around my neck, borrowed one of Dad's jackets that draped fashionably down to the knees.
Do you have a photo of this?
No, I don't, unfortunately.
Oh, damn.
It's before cameras.
There was, you know, like the nucleus of the Easy Beats were there. You know, there was so many great kids just wanted to escape.
Yeah, and at the same time, although I was probably a little bit older than them, the whole British migrant thing took over in Australia and especially in Adelaide.
Were you in a band before the Twilights, or was that the nucleus of your first band?
No, I was in vocal group. My friends and I, we decided to...
Yeah.
To form of a three-piece vocal group. We called ourselves, well, we were four-piece to begin with, called ourselves Checkmates. And then our bass singer got arrested for selling stolen goods. So he had to leave. And then we carried on backing up people like Bobby Bright, who was a bit of a teenage idol in early days of Adelaide.
He had his first gig in Adelaide, didn't he?
Yeah, well, he grew up there, and Doug Ashdown was in his band. He was the first guy we saw with a red Stratocaster, Telecaster, whatever it is. And then 63, I mean, I'm going through a couple of years here. We sang Beach Boys, we sang Danny and the Juniors, a bit of folk music, Blowing in the Wind and stuff like that. And then in 1963, we heard Please Please Me. And there was another seismic shift. Please Please Me was the first Beatles song released here. What was the first one? Love Me Do came after that.
Yeah.
But yeah. I heard Please...
And Then I Want to Hold Your Hand, yeah, isn't it?
I heard Please Please Me and thought, oh, the Everly Brothers. They've gone electric or something.
Yes.
And no, it was these guys, the four mop tops from Liverpool.
That's why you had a sense of harmonising.
Yeah.
By doing that three vocals, you learned how to harmonise. So that was...
The Everly Brothers taught me,
yeah,
really,
yeah,
how to sing. But I just had a natural ear for it, Gavin. When I would hear a song, I found myself singing a harmony part to it. I don't know how and why, but yeah, it sounded like that, because it sounded like the Everly Brothers. And of course, the Beatles were very influenced by that as well. Hi, this is Glenn Shorrock, and you're listening to the Gavin Wood Countdown Podcast.
So when you formed the Twilights, you know, the rumours coming out of Adelaide was there's this unbelievable band in Adelaide that sound like the Beatles. You were yeah, just notes spot on with everything.
Yeah, we pretty much were. So we were lucky enough to be young guys that just were able to do it naturally. No one told us how to do it. We listened to it and then copied it and did it.
So where did you find Paddy?
Well, he was my mate. He was part of the original vocal group. Right.
Oh, I see. Okay, it falls into place now.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah. He was one of the singers in the Checkmates. And then Terry Britton was the third harmony. And Peter Bridoak could sing a bit.
Right, good.
John Bywell was on bass, who's still playing in Adelaide, which is great. We just found out that we could make the sound. We didn't just copy the Beatles. We copied all the Merseyside and English stuff that was going on. Plus, of course, there was still American music coming in.
Apart from the Hollies, I mean, you were the only basically full-on harmony rock band that was going around, weren't you?
There was only a few. There was a band called Strangers in Melbourne. You know, they were pretty good. We just harmonised so well together and blended so well together, and I've always been in search of that.
Mm.
I've got to say I can do it naturally. You know what I mean? I don't have to work at it. And that stood us in good stead when I eventually ended up with Birdles and Gobles.
Yes.
Who were also very good harmony singers.
Beeb came from Adelaide?
Yep, and Graham.
And Graham, okay.
Yeah.
So you knew them then while you're in the Twilights, though. Well, Mississippi came a little later, didn't they?
Yeah. We can't leave out Axiom with Brian Catt, of course.
Well, that was Australia's first supergroup. That was the next step on from basically the Twilights, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Twilights split, finished up after 6 years in 1969, and I fell into bed with Brian.
My hello,
And a funny thing was we hatched the plan at Ian Meldrum's place.
Is that right? That's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do yourself a favor. Take the stress away from moving home. Contact whitegovemover.com.au.
Next, Molly with Hunkra.
Hi, this is Ian Molly Meldrum with my dear, dear friend Gavin Wood with his Countdown podcast. Glenn was one of the pilots of Ryan. I was a big fan of Glenn right back, yeah? And then obviously with his bands and that, he was such a professional. And coming from Adelaide, yeah, he just knew how to do it. And it wasn't unusual for all bands to be playing 3 gigs a day, actually. And Glenn would be up there all the time. And he was such a fine singer, an amazing singer. Without a doubt, for the Australian music industry, set an entire legacy, like John O'Keefe did and all. But definitely Glenn did as well, yeah.
One of my all-time favourite songs, and I still play it, is My Baby's Gone.
Oh, really?
I still reckon that is one of the most perfect songs I've ever heard.
Oh, really? That's unusual. I mean, not unusual. I mean, that's different. I don't get much compliments about that song. We were a bit disappointed, actually, when we heard what Shel Talmy had done to it. He had all the horns and strings and stuff, which didn't go down too well because we were trying to be a bit more rootsy and like the band.
Right, okay.
But Baby's Gone, yeah, I still do it now and again when,
good on you.
When Brian and I get together.
Yeah. Well, it's just one of those songs. And I think, you know, I was a viewer of Uptight and Happening 70. I mean, that was my era as a boy being influenced by music, and I totally consumed those shows. And I love the Twilights, you know, one of my favorite bands of all time. And then When You Broke Up and formed Axiom, and that was the song you released, you know, when you went to England and stuff. And it was just, I think it was just a very special song.
Yeah, it was great, and we shouldn't have split up, but that's the way it was. We only had 2 years together. The English winter played havoc with Don Moody's health.
Yeah. So Brian Cadd always tells the story, Axiom should have turned right instead of turning left.
Yeah.
They should have gone to America.
Yeah, we zagged and we should have zigged.
Yeah.
We were made for America, really. Our hearts were set, you know, on playing that sort of Americana music, as it wasn't called in those days, but it is now. Country and Western, really.
Well,
really, a lot of rock.
Yeah, rock.
A mixture.
But a good mixture.
The Gavin Wood Countdown Podcast is proudly brought to you by Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives every day of the year. Visit tobinbrothers.com.au.
Hi, this is Glenn Shorrock, and you're listening to the Gavin Wood Countdown Podcast.
Now, tell me, after Axiom broke up in England, you went on to join Esperanto, is that right?
Yep. I got a publishing contract with Man Records, and I was writing a few tunes. The early version of Help Is On Its Way, and I wrote that then.
Okay.
Statue of Liberty, Emma. The early LRB songs I wrote around that stage. But Esperanto was the idea of, who was it? David Mackay, who was an Australian record producer who was working in England.
Yep.
And he'd been given a brief about forming a rock orchestra. And he chose me as being the front man.
Perfect choice.
But the real musical genius behind that outfit was a guy called Ramon Vincent, who was the premier violinist in the Belgian Symphony Orchestra and wanted to be a pop star. And so we had a string quartet. We had three backup singers, one of them being Janice Slater.
And I remember it was a huge band. There was a lot of people in it.
12-piece.
Yeah.
It was totally unwieldy. And we survived about 9 months, I think, and toured in Europe a little. But as you say, it was just too many people to feed.
Yeah.
But it was interesting. You know, different music, very avant-garde.
So what happened, Glenn, after Esperanto finished?
Oh, I carried on doing some session work. And then I got a call from Cliff Richard's management through David Mackay. There was a bit of an Aussie mafia in London at the time. You know, Cliff was using Terry Britton and Kevin Peake as his backup people that time, and he wanted another voice, and they picked me. So I did a few sessions with him, and we did the Palladium for 8 weeks. That was fantastic. And but by this stage, I was getting, you know, it had been 5 years or 4 years. I was thinking, I'm not getting any further here. I think I'll come back to Australia and see what I can pick up. I thought maybe I could be an agent or a manager, which I'd briefly been before Axiom when I managed the Brisbane Avengers.
Jones and Stretch and all of them. Yeah.
Indeed. Oh, yes, you remember them. Right.
Listen was the hit.
Was it the hit?
Well, it wasn't. Well, it was a moderate
radio hit.
Radio hit, yeah. One of the greatest singers in the world and one of the nicest men, Glenn Shorrock. Now, Glenn, we're on this journey. You're coming back to Australia.
Flattery will get you everywhere, Gavin.
Well, it's true. I don't lie. I don't lie, Glenn.
Well, you have good taste.
Yes, of course I do. So you're coming back to Australia. You might think you're coming back with your tail between your legs, but Australia doesn't think so because you're much loved. So
yeah.
What was the transition? What happened when you came back?
Well, I'd already met Bertels and Goebel and Palicki,
right.
Brokered by Glenn Wheatley, who I'd known obviously through uh-huh. Master's Apprentices, and they were thinking about, you know, that they'd broken up. Mississippi had broken up in London, and they were going to have a crack at America,
right.
But
yeah.
They wanted to do it back home in Australia, and I said, okay, I'll have a crack at that, mainly because we sang It's a Long Way There in perfect harmony and played a few other tunes. I played them, Statue of Liberty that I had, and Hell Was on Its Way, and
yeah,
and so we had a strong arsenal of about 50 songs, and we returned to, we ended up in Jim Keyes' place in Carlton, actually.
Right.
I'd had a few weeks back in Adelaide alongside Graham. He was, you know, reuniting with his family as well, and we worked a few things, and it all came together in Melbourne, though, and we finally got a bass player by the name of Roger McLaughlin
and
Rick Formosa.
Yeah,
and,
the original lineup. The original, because Curiosity Killed the Cat, that came out in 75.
Correct, yes. And we got a record contract pretty easily with EMI because Beeb and I and Graham, of course, were, you know, had some credibility, didn't we, with
absolutely
the bands that we've been in.
Yeah.
And I thought of the name Little River from the sign going down the Geelong. Little River exit.
Going down the Geelong Road and the turn off to Little River.
Little River exit 1 mile, as they say.
You were desperate for a name and you couldn't find anything, and all of a sudden you looked up at the street sign. It's amazing, yeah. Isn't it? So simple.
So simple. I thought of it first as a song, Little River. And then, well, Little River Band, that sounds okay. I mean, the gag is we could have been called A Wrong Way Go Back. Or Men at Work, think about that.
Yes, that would have been complicated.
Hi, this is Glenn Shorrock, and you're listening to the Gavin Woods Countdown Podcast.
I do remember when you were going around on your first promotion tour, for Curiosity Killed the Cat, I was doing radio Saturday afternoon up in Brisbane at a station called 4BK, and all of you came into the studio. Usually when you do an interview with a band, it's either the lead singer or the keyboard player or something, but we had, you know, six people in this crappy little studio and me, a young announcer. And I was very intimidated, but very excited at the same time to have my heroes my musical heroes in the one room. It was just fantastic.
Yeah, it was good fun. We had a great start. We were very lucky. As I say, we had great material and we had credibility as well. And plus, of course, we could reproduce the sound on stage live.
So tell me, when you first got together with Beeb and Graham and you did your first practice session and you put your vocals in the slot, the three of you, how did you feel?
The blend was there. As I said before, the three of us knew how to blend together. There's a certain way you can alter your voice to complement the other voices and the overall sound of the harmony. And the three of us were well versed in that. There was no difficulty in that at all. Plus, of course, the writing was good, was strong. You know, Graham is writing some great songs, still is, and Beeb as well. Yeah. And you know, I had my little collection of material that I brought back from England.
So, tell me about the rise of LRB in Australia and the future plans to get to America.
The first single was destined to be the old Everly Brothers song, right. When Will I Be Loved? We felt that was a good way to get that sound across. Linda Ronstadt put it out just before we did.
Of course she did.
So we pulled that. Yeah. So we pulled that and went with Plan B, which was Curiosity Killed the Cat. Right. And that was a great radio hit for us.
Certainly was.
And we had our name, we had our look, we had a good manager, a good record company, and you know, what could go wrong, really? And we could play.
Yes.
We could do it.
Yeah. Well, there are some photos of you guys on stage. I think it's down in Texas in the big open bowl down there with, you know, 80,000 people.
Yeah, that was Dallas Cotton Bowl, whatever it's called. We did a lot of those great big summer festivals over the years. You know, we toured America. Well, I toured America with that band for 7 years, I think, seven or eight years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We changed a bit, you know. McLaughlin and Formosa fell by the wayside, and George McArdle and David Briggs took their place, and that was the classic lineup that the Americans know.
The Lonesome Loser, David Briggs. Yeah.
David Briggs wrote that, right?
Yeah.
So you know, we had a good run in America. Fantastic. I think we had about eight top 20 songs in the charts in a row. And some of them got to the top 10, top 5, Reminiscing and Lady. Elvis on its Way was a top 10. And, yeah, so it was a purple patch, as I call it.
And now you're getting radio plays for, you know, a million plays on the radio. You're getting awards like that now. It just goes to show how good the band was and how good the songwriting was and how good the hits were.
Indeed. And, of course, streaming now is another fillip, as it were, picked up our exposure again. People are streaming our songs as well, because the sales of hardware, shall we call it, is diminished. Very, very much so. It's all pay as you play, which is what I do as well.
How I get my music
now.
Well, my good mate who lives in Laguna Hills rang me a couple of months ago and he said, "Gavin, you didn't tell me that the Little River Band were from Australia?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, man," he said, "cool change." He said, "It's just blown my head apart. It's one of the greatest songs I've ever heard." So you'll find people coming into your library and rediscovering Little River Band all over again.
I know. It's great. And we're enjoying that. Unfortunately, we don't own the name, but we certainly own the music.
Yeah, well, I was going to touch on that, and there's probably only so much we can say, but we're all disappointed about that, because when I was in LA for 12 years, I'd be listening to a radio spot promoting your cover band in the States using your music on the radio ads, and it just pissed me off no end.
Yeah, well, you can imagine how we feel.
Yes,
as well.
Yes, I know.
Graham, and David are very militant about regaining our credibility.
Okay.
They're working on that. I myself have taken that as an irritation, and because basically, Little River Band was a great band, but I'd been in great bands before, and you know, I didn't want to stop performing just because I'd lost the Little River Band name. I sang most of the hits anyway, everybody knew that sound. So no, I've never stopped doing what I've always done, and that's I'll make a machinery behind the popular song.
There's a wonderful song that Graham wrote, "Someone's Taken Our History," which sums it up perfectly. Someone sings our songs for free every night when we got on the bus. You know, it's just,
yeah.
And it's still in my library. I love the song, but it's, to me, it's a sad song.
Yeah, it is. It is a sad song. And as I said, Graham and Bebo are working hard.
Good.
To reverse that. Not. I don't want to get the band back together. I'm quite happy. But doing what I'm doing.
But even if you went out as, like, there's the big heritage market, you know, in the outdoor market in the States that, you know, you could do a couple of months tour and just clean up as the original Little River Band.
Mm. Yep, I know. I could have done that by myself as well, but I kept getting injunctions thrown at me.
Yeah, well, that's...
By the powers that be. Which are the Little River Band by name.
Mm, mm.
Stephen Housden.
Wayne Nelson.
Wayne Nelson, you know, they've been running that band now for a number of years.
Yep.
But, you know, it's wearing thin. I mean, in this era now with the virus that is stopping us all in our tracks, they're not making any headway at all.
Probably.
So I don't know what's going to happen to me either, but thankfully I've got that body of work behind me that I can still get an audience to listen to the Little River Band music.
Well, as a solo singer, as Bertel Shorrock Goebel on the Countdown Tour, you're absolutely magnificent. That was probably the most powerful 12 minutes I've ever seen on stage. And you just killed them every night you're out there. And also,
also
as a solo singer, Glenn Shorrock singing solo, you still kill them because of what you've done, the history that you've got. And people, you know, they never forget you because you're part of their lives.
Yeah, I know. I've heard that all my life, and it's not been part of my life. It's been all my life ever since I was a teenager. I mean, I was idle before I was a teenager.
That's very good. That could go in a song.
Peter Sellers. That's a Peter Sellers gig.
Oh, is it? Okay.
No, this is all I've ever done. I had a couple of years where I was a part-time pop star in Adelaide, and then by the time I got to Melbourne, I was fully-fledged entertainer. And I've been doing that all my life. I've been very lucky.
You know, Glenn Shorrock, there are some great names like the Little River Band. You know, it's the band makes the name, of course. But I think the best name for a duo or a group is the Blazing Salads.
Thank you. Brian and I thought that up, didn't we? Accidentally.
Who came up with it and how many bottles of red did it take?
Oh, about five. Yeah, I love that one. What's the guy's name?
You must have had a great time, you know, touring as the Blazing Salads.
Oh, we didn't. We should have called ourselves Shorrock Cab, really.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people said, what the hell is that? Blazing Salads. It's Blazing Salads. No, you missed the point. It's a gag. No.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's just very funny. It just proves that you've got a great sense of humour and the record business hasn't damaged you.
No, it hasn't. And having a sense of humour hasn't damaged me either. It's been a saving grace for myself and Brian and a lot of other people who I laugh alongside, Russell and John Paul Young. Mm. You know, we're all good pals, and we've got that fellowship, that heritage fellowship about us, which is nice.
John Paul Young told me we were standing side stage while you're on stage at the Countdown Spectacular, singing. And John Paul Young said, gee. I said, what's wrong? He said, Shorrock. I said, what about him? He said, he stays up all night and then he gets up on stage and sings like a bird.
I know. I don't think I could do that now.
Well, mate, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Good luck with the Little River Band expose.
The saga continues.
Maintain the rage.
Maintain the rage. The ghost of LRB still walks.
Good on you. Well, we're all very happy about that. Now, what we do at the end of these podcasts, Glenn, is we ask 10 easy questions.
Okay.
It's like the top 10, like Countdown.
Yeah. Yep.
So the first question is, who inspired you to make music?
Elvis Presley, the Everly Brothers, Little Richard were my earliest influences in the rock and roll idiom. And, of course, Lennon and McCartney and the other two blokes who changed everything.
Fantastic. Second question, what have you learnt over your musical journey?
Nothing.
Good answer. Question three, what was the effect of Countdown on your career?
Exposure. Yeah, national exposure. Lots of laughs backstage, lots of fun, and the formation of the real Australian sound and record, music industry, I think.
Yeah. Now, the next question, if you could open up a show for any artist in the world, living or dead, who would it be?
God, that's a tough one. The Beatles.
Oh, yes. Do you want to be heard? All right, so name three dinner guests, dead or alive.
Peter Sellers, George Martin. Oh, Brian. Brian Catt will do.
That's enough.
He can open the bottles.
Yes. What's your favourite song to perform on stage?
Perform on stage, Cool Change.
Yeah, beautiful.
But there are so many great songs that I've been in the pleasure to sing, not only mine and Little River Band, but it's just so much great material that I've grown up with.
Mm.
I count Drift Away as one of my favourite songs. Because
yeah,
that encapsulates that way I feel about my life.
So what's the most trouble you've gotten into?
Oh, God. Where do I start? Have you read the book? Oh, yeah. I got myself into a few scrapes, but by and large, get my head above water and had a happy life.
Fantastic. Now, if you could change anything about the music industry, what would you change?
I wouldn't change anything. It's become... how do I put this? It began as a hobby for me and took me to the top of the tree, and it's sustained me now for 50-odd years. The industry itself, I don't look at it as an industry. I look at it as an art form, a creative business. Industry doesn't suit the music industry, I don't think. It's
right.
It needs... flexibility. It can't be too rigid.
Sure.
And we've got a great genre laden library to draw from now.
Yes, it's getting quite diverse, isn't it?
Very, yeah.
So second last question, what's the best show that you've ever done?
Oh, another one's hard. I guess the Dallas Cotton Bowl was one of them. Oh, and also I must the show I produced with George Martin called All You Need Is Beatles, where I got to work alongside him with some great Australian musicians. And
that looked huge.
You know, we did all the great orchestral hits from the Beatles. That was a wonderful six concerts that I produced. That goes up there.
Right. So, final question to Glenn Shorrock. What have you learnt and what would you pass on to a young, hopeful musician?
Passion, perseverance, and patience. Three P's.
Right.
And go for it. You know, just do what you do. Do well, boy.
Well, Glenn, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak with one of my idols. And to grow up with you in the music industry and then work with you, it's just been absolutely brilliant. So I thank you very much from the bottom of my heart.
Okay.
And good luck with everything you do. If you're in Melbourne and you want a beer and you can, give me a call. We'll catch up.
Good on you, man. All the best, Gavin. Thank you.
Gavin Wood's Countdown podcast was thanks to Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.